So about half a year ago, I was once talking with Tony at the coffee break at 3 o'clock, and he mentioned to me that quite a few people, well, have never read the book by Wolfram, but are commenting on this book, and usually the comments are quite negative. That Tony didn't like that, and he was, pardon?
A little bit louder. Can you keep it back here? Yeah. How about lights off?
And so he was basically asking, has somebody read the book or not? And it turned out that by that time I was almost finished reading the book, and I said that yes, I have read it, and that I have mixed feelings about the book, that I can't say that all of it is garbage, as many people do say, and obviously not everything in the book is either new kind of science, a science at all, or anything that is actually describable in a few short words. So Tony asked me to give this talk, and I agreed, which I probably shouldn't have, because it's kind of strange given the first colloquium at ITP, which is not on your own work, it's kind of strange. And then further, such a big audience, I don't remember ever having such a big audience in the ITP colloquium all the 2 years which I was here. Anyway, the other thing is that I'm also supposed to give a colloquium on a book which I have to say I'm not an expert on. I haven't studied it, I have only read it, I have, you know, made my opinions, but I've only read it, and I'm not an expert on many of the things which I discussed there. So if you start asking questions, I may not be able to answer them, which also puts me in kind of awkward position. But, you know, this being said, let's start. And I have to warn you that I'll probably run slightly over 1 hour, usual 50 minutes, which the talks last year, but I think this is tolerable given the size of the book, which is 1,200 pages, right? Okay, so what's the purpose of this talk? When I was reading, the purpose of the talk is, for me at least, is about the same which I had when I actually grabbed the book and started to read it. So the first one is, I want actually to figure out what is that new science that Wolfram is talking about? What are those elements of, what are those new things which he is talking about? And from the cover, you can't see them, so you have actually to go into the details and to read the whole stuff. And so, as a brief summary, yes, I think I believe that there are some new, some interesting features in the book, new being 20 years old, probably 15 years old, produced by Wolfram and other people circa 1985, and some newer things, but I don't quite know if there is a new science there. The next question is, I want to analyze philosophical significance of these new results, right? And here I see that, you know, there is a bunch of questions which have been raised by Wolfram, which were at least very new to me and quite striking to me, but I'm pretty sure that all the people in the audience will recognize them as being asked in, you know, 1700s or 1900s, depending on the age of those people. I see some nice, interesting philosophical questions being raised, but again, I'm not good at philosophy, I don't know much of it. The next point is, well, I actually wanted to see if there is any traditional science that can help us to deal with the new science. Basically, it's a 1,200-page book. Can I apply some of traditional science to make it slightly shorter? That's the objective. And the next point is, the brief summary is, I think there are things that can be done with traditional science, which Wolfram didn't bother to do. The next point is, to see if there are any implications of this new science to traditional ones, or actually to traditional scientists, which basically, if all of the stuff which we are doing is just garbage, then, you know, we should find other jobs. And my brief summary is that there are probably very few implications, because the new science which Wolfram is suggesting is actually non-predictive science. It's stamp collecting in exactly the same sense as Rutherford uses stamps. I want to summarize that all of what I'm saying is not Wolfram views, this is my understanding of what he's saying after I read the book. Now, what the talk is not going to be about. I'm not going to criticize either the citation style or presentation style of the book. A lot has been done in this direction, and I'm not going to do this. I'm going to talk about the essence of the book. I'm not going to criticize the possible immodesty of the text. Again, a lot has been done on this direction. I'm not going to analyze, you know, scientific ownership issues, social scientific conduct issues related to some of the results presented in this book, and there are a few, and again, they have been discussed quite extensively, so I'm not going to deal with this. Finally, I'm not going to analyze other people's reviews and opinions about the book because, well, the two most famous in this audience, two most famous reviews are by Weinberg and by Kadanoff, and frankly, I think that the review of Weinberg is more about Weinberg than about Wolfram, and the review of Kadanoff is more about Kadanoff than it's about Wolfram. So I'm not going to analyze those things. The structure of the talk, well, I'll basically try to follow the book and give some of my own comments about this book. The book has basically three main parts. The first is chapters 1 to 6, which is zoology of cellular automata and other simple programs. Basically, Wolfram goes exhaustively through all possible simple programs, starting from the simplest one and, you know, further and further, as high as his computers allow him to do.
There's still and some empty chairs in front here. People want to come up and hear. Yes, sorry.
This part of the book is actually a quite complete and well-developed part. You can actually see very nice logical structure and a few nice points in that parts. Chapters 7 to 9 are applications of his new science to natural sciences. And the points here are, well, they range from some which are very cute but probably are quite useless to some which are basically grand claims which are at the moment not supported by experiment but are provocative and, what I want to emphasize, are not outright incorrect, not outright absurd. Wolfram knows some basic science and he would not be putting outright absurd results in his book. Well, he knows a lot more than basic science, I believe. But chapters 10 to 12 is basically the concept of computation, how is it related to the science, the rest of the new kind of science. And here I think that the main significance of those parts is probably philosophical, but it has very little natural scientific value, at least my understanding. So let's start with the zoology of cellular automaton. Just in case, you know, some people may not know what cellular automaton is, this is a very simple example. Basically, cellular automaton, one-dimensional cellular automaton is just line of, let's call them spins, or, you know, which can be then plus one half, minus one half states, or zero ones, or is this a black or white squares. And there is a definite evolution rule which takes this sequence at time t to time t plus one. In the very simplest case, this evolution rule depends on, is the following basically. Can I have a pointer, please? Oh, thanks. In the very simple case, the evolution rule basically depends. You know, this is one of the simplest evolution rules. The color or the value of a cell at the next step, over here, depends only on the value of the cell at the previous step and of its two nearby neighbors at the previous step. So, for example, in this example, you know, if the cell itself and two of its neighbors are black, the cell is going to be white, hence zero. And similarly, if it's black, black, white, it's going to be white, again, zero. You can write actually a very nice nomenclature of this cellular automaton, basically just, you know, writing down all possible prior states and seeing what other states in the future are going to be. And this is a 8-bit number, so there are a total 256 possible such simple cellular automaton. And the one which I give here is the rule 30. It's a famous rule 30, which is one of the most interesting rules in among the cellular automatons. So this is how the evolution looks. And here I have to make a few comments. Basically, Wolfram has spent 10 years writing his book, and he has all beautiful pictures, so I decided to shortcut and just copy scan actually pictures from his book. So pictures do not look very nice. If you want to see something which is more crisp, you have to take, you know, to get the book. I don't want to spend 10 years writing this presentation. Basically, that's the point. So this is rule 30. That's how it behaves starting from black background and white cell on top of this black background and starting with two white cells and random initial conditions. And what you see is that in the first two cases there is definitely some structure over here, right? But the rest looks almost random, right? In the last case, everything actually does look random. So it's a very simple rule, but at least partially it produces random behavior, which is a very cute observation, which is what Wolfram says triggered his whole interest in cellular automata in 1978 or something like that. What are other possible examples of evolution of cellular automata? This is a rule called 40, and starting from a single cell, it produces random uniform black picture. Two cells produces random uniform black picture. Random cells, well, the structure actually very quickly dies out. It again becomes an almost uniformly black picture. So this evolution evolves to a very simple fixed point. So this is rule 9. Starting from one cell, well, this is a picture, two cells, three cells. So basically what this rule is pretty much a repetitive structure with just motion to the right. It's a very, very simple fixed point of the evolution of this. It's a cycle of the evolution, a limit cycle for the evolution. Next is rule 18, which produces a very intricate nested behavior. Now you have two nested structures on top of each other, and now you have something which looks almost random, but then something comes out on top of it, which is not random at all, right? Big black triangle. The next one, and I'm not going to go forever, it's only a few more left. So this is rule 54, which if you look at this first two, is pretty much regular, just very regular lines. But if you look at the last one, and again I think there is alias in here, but basically what you should see is that there are lines here on top of a more or less regular background. There are lines which collide with each other, merge, etc., etc. So it's sort of a semi-random behavior. And then finally, the most interesting or the most famous of all of these rules is rule 110, which even starting from a simple initial condition, so here you have randomness, here you have randomness, right? But in these regions over here, you have a regular background on top of which there are something that looks like persistent structures which collide with each other and propagate, etc., etc. And similar stuff happens with the random background. You have random initial conditions, regular background, and on top of this there is this multitude of persistent structures, right? Which look like basically people jumping into each other, talking to each other, and basically particles moving. And so it's quite interesting how the simple behavior can emerge from this very complex behavior can emerge from this very simple cellular automaton. So having noticed that, what Wolfram does is, well, he does zoology. He goes and studies all possible other simple programs and see if he can get something which is more, which is different from this behavior of the simplest cellular automaton. So he does two and three dimensional cellular automatons, including game of life. He does multicolor, long-range, long-memory cellular automaton, mobile automaton, Turing machines, substitution, multi-way symbolic systems, basically you name it. Then he does register systems, which are basic computers on everybody's desk. Then he goes to do numerology, which is studying the structure of symbolic representation of different numbers, and whether the structure exhibits any randomness, structure, or complexity. And what he does is, he looks at arithmetic operations, for example, like multiplication by 3 and base 2, whether it produces any intricate behavior in the symbolic sequence, recursive sequences, continued fractions, sequence of primes, sequence of what are the numbers, number sequence for important constants like e or pi. And for example, e turns out to be a recursive sequence, while pi is actually a more or less random sequence. Looks at iterated maps, chaos, etc., etc. Basically, as I say, he does zoology of all of these things. And everywhere he has the following observations. First observation is that very different types of behavior are possible, from very simple to very complex or to very random in all of these particular systems. The question which you should ask yourself at this point, probably even earlier, what is complex, what is random? So far he hasn't defined this, so I'm also not defining this, and we'll have to leave this for future. Similar statement holds basically for random and regular initial conditions. It doesn't matter what you start from, random or regular, you still can evolve to either random final outputs or regular final outputs or something in between. If the systems are constrained, that is, for example, you impose time reversal invariance or symmetry or anything else, slightly more complex rules are needed, but still with those slightly more complex rules, you will be able to achieve all those possible types of behavior. And so his basic, his main claim, his biggest sort of most important point of the first part of the book is that simple programs can generate complex output. So that's what you probably should get out of the first three or four chapters. It's only this very simple statement. And further is that beyond some threshold, adding complexity to rules doesn't increase complexity of the output. If you add some complexity to rule 110, you don't get anything that looks more complex than the original picture produced by rule 110. That's another point which he makes. Further, he notices that only very, very few programs, notably those which evolve to attractors, can be predicted. You can predict what the output of those programs is going to be. But for the vast majority of programs, there is no easy way, or at least he didn't find it, how to predict what the outcome of the program is going to be. Well, question which again you should ask yourself at this point is, do we actually want to make predictions of all of these intricate details? Maybe we want to talk about some kind of averaged behaviors, like what we do in thermodynamics. And I'm going to talk about this later, somewhat later. Next observation which he makes is that if, for example, you constrain your system, for example, you say that my system has to have the same number of black points at every line, then it's very difficult to get complex behavior. He was able to produce something which looked like nested structure, but nothing which was either random or as complex as rule 110. So constraints, rather than basically explicit evolution rules, what you do on the next step, are not as good in producing complex behavior. And that's what he says is one of the problems with traditional science, which is basically what it does. The traditional science uses equations which are basically constraints on evolution rather than proper evolution, and you should not be able to get any kind of this intricate behavior in traditional science. What he notices is that, again, actually he doesn't notice this. I decided to notice it here, is that nothing interesting happens for systems which are either finite in size or the systems which are 0 plus 1 dimensional, which again should remind you, it smells very much like statistical mechanics. Nothing interesting happens for short systems which are of one dimension. He never shows us, actually, even though he claims that he does, any kind of systems in which these different strange behaviors happen in a continuous system. I don't know whether this is an important point or not, but I just want to make sure that this is a... This is sad. So after reading this first few chapters, what is my understanding of what is this new kind of science is according to Wolfram? The first thing is that, as far as I understand, what he suggests us to do is to, instead of derive equations and solve for constraint evolution, instead we should exhaustively search for solutions and do this on computers, basically do computer simulations. What he says further is that complexity of the world may actually come from, or all of the complexity in the world comes from probably very, very simple programs. And here is the quote from him, that intuition from traditional science has always tended to suggest that unless one adds all sorts of complications, more systems will never be able to exhibit any relevant behavior. And so he claims that this is not true in his science. Further, he says what I think is what he tries to say in this new kind of science is that the threshold for this not shortcuttable complexity which you cannot predict, which you actually have to completely evaluate in order to understand what's going to happen, is very low. Only very, very, you only need very, very simple rules to achieve something which you cannot shortcut. And this is his problem with physics. Physics actually wants to make predictions all the way, try to make different calculations. Further, he says that we should focus on discrete systems, and actually on evolution of those systems rather than constraints. Okay, so this is what I understand, what I think he is trying to say us in the first four or five chapters of the book, probably four chapters of the book. Now the question is there anything of this new kind of science? The first thing is, even though I would never do exhaustive search for solutions, I actually do use computers. So the first point is actually not that important, I think. The second one, which is one I alluded to already, is that if you actually want to as to understand what is the position of all of the molecules in this room, in the air of, in this room, you will have to do very, very detailed computer simulations, right? However, we have developed tools which let us shortcut this, which we're actually not interested in all of those positions. They are of no predictive values. We will not be able to extract anything relevant from them. So what we do instead, we do statistical mechanics and we focus on average, you know, ensemble quantities. So maybe, you know, maybe the systems are not irreducible, but who cares? Regarding his point that, you know, he's the first one to discover a simple system which produces complex behavior, well, I would argue that harmonic oscillator is actually a very, very simple thing. But if you put a bunch of harmonic oscillators together and couple them, then you get quantum field theory, and apparently this is what describes the world around us. And the world is definitely complex. So this is, I don't think that this is his claim to fame. People have known this for ages now. Actually, I do think that the analogy between stellar automaton and quantum field theory is actually can be developed further, and I'm entertaining the possibility of actually looking into it and doing some calculations. Basically, if you decimate, actually average out some of the points on the lattice on the in the cellular automaton, what you will see is that the rules of evolution now become non-deterministic but rather probabilistic rules. And what you can ask yourself is, basically, if I do this sort of randomization group type approach with different cellular automaton with different evolution rules, what will I come to? And my suspicion is, which is at the moment only suspicion, that if you do it, for example, on rule 30, what you will come to, you will come to a disordered system. If you do it on rule 110, you'll probably stay right at the, you know, at the critical point. If you do it for rule, let's say 9, you will get to a very ordered phase. So I think that we can probably try to apply standard physics to analyze the behavior of the stellar automaton. This basically summarizes the first four or so chapters of the book. What he goes to do next is he defines classification of stellar automata, which is very much similar to what I already talked about. The classification depends on how stellar automata behave for random initial conditions. But again, so far we don't know what randomness is. He hasn't defined it to us, and all of the old science has to go down the drain, so we shouldn't believe all the old definitions. So what exactly does he mean by randomness? I don't know. But let's follow him and do it in chronological order. So class one of cellular automatons. This is automata which evolve to stable state. They are insensitive to initial conditions. Class two, they evolve to a periodic state or sometimes approximately nested state, and they're somewhat sensitive to initial conditions. Class three, they behave randomly. They're very sensitive to initial conditions, basically if you make a small perturbation, then perturbation spreads out linearly. And class 4, which has a semi-random structure on top of regular background, and the initial conditions do spread. You are sensitive to initial conditions, but the spread is some linear. And so what he says is that the complexity basically grows from 1 to 4, the lowest complexity and the highest complexity. I would actually, again, it's not his comment, this is my, I would also add another type of rules like rule 18 to the class 4, which is basically what you have is a semi-random structure, you remember that big triangle which I showed, on top of a completely random background. And in this case, what happens if you run the with slightly different initial conditions, what will happen is that your perturbation will spread very, very fast in the background, but it will spread very, very slow in the foreground, which is on top. So now, what are the problems with this classification? This actually is the only place where I refer to Weinberg's review, where he says that basically that all of these classifications are purely visual classification, and different people have different eyes. So what, you know, what good are these classifications? And so here are the comments actually from Wolfram himself. I base my classification purely on general visual appearances of the pattern. And further, there are rules that show some features of one class and some of the other, obviously. I mean, if you cannot provide a definite, precise definition of what you mean by one class and another, then some rules will look like, you know, partially one, partially like the other class. And what do you do with those? You don't know. There's actually a slightly bigger problem even with this. Wolfram talks about behavior for one particular initial condition. Instead, what you should do, in my view, is talk about the behavior of the cellular automaton for a class, for an ensemble of initial conditions. Rule 30, which we've seen is a very random rule, produces this very regular pictures if you apply it to some, you know, particularly chosen initial conditions. So complexity or classification scheme should be not only a function of a rule itself, but should be a function of the rule and the probability distribution from which the initial conditions are taken from. Because basically, if you have initial conditions which are 50% black, 50% white, this is random. But if you have initial conditions which are 30% black and 70% white, this is still random, but from a different ensembles. And this cellular automaton will behave differently if you feed them initial conditions from one random ensemble and from the other random ensemble. So you should be very careful about specifying these things. That's at least my view. Now I'm going to, you know, run some small infomercial here, which is basically, again, one thing which I'm entertaining of pursuing further. So can we actually make this classification scheme slightly more precise? In one part of my thesis, we have developed a complexity classification scheme actually for learning problems, which is based on mutual information between the past of the process and the future of the process. So what you do is, you know, to be very short, you calculate mutual information, you call it predictive information, you calculate mutual information between past and the future, and if the future goes to infinity, which means that you are estimating information that finite past gives about all of the future, then this becomes equal to the subextensive part of the entropy of the past. And, you know, in physics we know entropy is extensive, there is small correction, but it turns out that in many problems the correction is actually not that small. It may be a power law which is linear, which is sublinear, but it may actually grow all the way to infinity. And so what I did a few days ago, I just ran a very simple program on rule 110 and rule 30. And what you see is this is the entropy of the block of length n in the central column of the cellular automaton for rule 30 and rule 110. Obviously they have different slopes, right? This is very random, this is not, but what's important is that actually we have curvature over here. Curvature means that there is a subextensive term. And actually the first things which I sort of tried to see is that it looks like the entropy of the rule 110 is totally dominated by a subextensive term. There is almost no extensive piece to it. Which means that you know, there may be something in applying this type of classification which we have developed for learning problems to this application. And here what actually happens is that you are trying to learn initial conditions from the central column. And depending on the spread of information, this, you know, the spread of fluctuations in the system, this is either possible or impossible to do. And that's what defines these different behaviors. Okay? Now, having said that, having defined what the classes of cellular automaton are, Wolfram actually goes on and actually tries now to define what randomness and complexity is. So I'm following him linearly, so I'm going to do the same. What he says is that there are three types of randomness. The first one is randomness from the environment, heat bus, right? Which is the basis for all stochastic models which we do in physics. The second one is randomness from sensitivity to initial conditions, which is chaos. What you can imagine here is the following. Suppose you have a very long number, large number, which has an infinite digit sequence, and another number which has about the same sequence, first 100 bits of the sequence are the same, and then they start to deviate from each other. If you do shifts, if you basically shift this map at each step, one symbol to the left, and cut it, shift and cut, basically what will happen, you are just moving the randomness which is hidden there in the initial conditions further to the left, and eventually the two processes will diverge, right? This is the problem of, where randomness comes in chaos, that's what he claims. However, he also says that there is a third type of randomness in systems, which is intrinsic randomness generation, where you start from very regular initial conditions, but you get randomness, which is what we've seen for the cellular automaton rule 30, where you started from one point on top of a background and you got randomness. I have to say that I'm actually very uneasy with this thing. I've read through this, thought through this, and I do not see a very big distinction between rule, randomness part 2 and then I missed part 3. Basically, we don't know what the rules are there. The rules are basically what they're doing is they are encrypting the initial conditions. And so without talking about ensembles, without talking about, without giving a proper definition of what randomness is, you can't say that the regular rule, I mean, that black-white point on the black background is not just a random manifestation of some ensemble in which rule 30 looks random. So I don't quite know how to make a distinction between a random rule and, I'm sorry, random initial conditions and non-random initial conditions without actually defining what randomness is. And so here he has some kind of circular loop which at least I cannot break out from. Maybe some other people will be able to do. So finally, what he does for making a definition of randomness is that random sequences are those sequences which look random if analyzed by simple programs. This seems like a very crazy definition, right? But actually, it is not such a bad definition after all. I think actually one of the better ones which you can find in the literature. Well, let's first see what problems it gives, and then I'll explain why it's not such a bad thing after all. The problem immediately is that the classification for cellular automaton which it has just developed is not good anymore, because depending on which cellular automaton you use to analyze for randomness, the sequence is either going to be random or not, and so how do you define whether cellular automaton is in class 4 or class 3? Now, all this I already talked about. What he also says is that it's possible that there are just no truly random sequences, that all of the randomness which we have in the world, including randomness in quantum mechanics, is just randomness produced by simple programs from normal, regular initial conditions. An example of this would be probably all the random number generators which you know, linear congruential random number generators, which produce randomness, which is not very good randomness, but still some kind of randomness. And so what he says that probably world is just like that. Now, why is the definition good that he made basically? The way we study, we look at the sequence and we say whether the sequence is random or not. Basically, we look at it, it looks random, right? But our perception, our visual system is basically, it's a neural network which can be described by a very simple program. So our own interpretation of whether a sequence looks random or not is indeed based on performance of simple programs. So in this sense, the definition is not bad at all. Further, this definition resolves the problem of Kolmogorov complexity, algorithmic complexity, which basically tells you that only those strings which do not have short descriptions are complex, right? But you can never find out, maybe if I looked slightly harder, I would have found that complex description. The simple description. Here what he basically says is that, look, there is no randomness, there is just randomness. There is always randomness with respect to tools which you've used to identify them. So this actually sounds quite nice to me. And the point is that this is actually very similar to probabilistic inference models which people use, or recent works by Paul Vitani in a theory of algorithmic complexity or conditional complex sequences, where basically again you talk about randomness or complexity with respect to given model class. And that's what he's talking about. You have a model class, is a sequence complex or random with respect to that model class? And finally, just to end this discussion of random numbers, this was kind of a surprise to me, or many people probably know this already, is that Mathematica's call to random integer actually uses cellular automaton rule number 30. That's what it uses for generating random numbers. So basically, if you're using Mathematica, you've already endorsed the view that cellular rule number 30 is a random number generator. Which actually it is. It's quite a good random number generator. I spent 2 weeks trying to find problems in it with some nice tools, and I wasn't able to. We can discuss it later. Now, since I do not quite understand what's the distinction between randomness rule 2 and rule 3, I wanted to spend yet one more slide on it, which will probably make it even worse. At least for me, it makes the distinction between them even worse. So what he says is that the distinction between rule 2 and 3 is the following. You try to set up an experiment which is very cleanly set up so that you know that there is no sensitivity to initial conditions, and you get repetitive randomness, something which looks like random but repeats from experiment to experiment. And then that's what he calls randomness of type 3. But again, I don't quite know what do you mean by looks random. And so the example which she does is, he had some very good papers in end of 80s on deriving Navier-Stokes equation from cellular automatons. I actually like those papers, I read them. And what he shows that basically this is a simulation of cellular automaton, two-dimensional cellular automaton. You run without randomness, and eventually what comes out is a normal eddy structure, which is sort of a signature of turbulence. You do get randomness out of nowhere. And so what he says is that if you look carefully enough, you will see that things which do look random are actually not random, but repeatable. So, you know, maybe we should look for this, but the problem which I have, it's a conceptual problem. What do you mean repeatable but random? I just don't get it somehow. Final comment about the randomness which I'm going to make is the following. The question which you asked is, why do you need this third type of randomness? We have two and this should be enough. And his assertion is that basically these first two randomness from environment and from chaos are not enough to produce what we see, for example, in statistical mechanics, where systems tend to sample all of the ensemble of possible states. So what he says is that basically you can set up initial conditions very nice, very cleanly, and then you don't have second type of randomness. And then, you know, there are billions and billions of states in the system. How can you possibly sample them fast if you don't have intrinsic randomness generation? That's his point. And, well, when I was an undergraduate, I did a very simple calculation. Suppose if you move an electron 1 centimeter, electron on a nearby star 4 light years away by 1 centimeter, how long will it take until the whole motion of particles in the room is going to be appreciably different, right? And it takes exactly 4 years for the light to come in, and then, you know, 10^-5 seconds for things to change. So I actually do not buy his argument here that you do need sort of type of randomness in order to have statistical mechanics. I think we have quite enough from not being able to insulate our systems from the outside perturbations. Now, we finished talking about randomness. Let's sort of recapture this and talk about what does he mean by complexity. And so again, the crucial points about randomness were that randomness only exists with respect to particular tools which you are using to identify it. So what he says is that in traditional science, it has been assumed that any result that is not essentially independent of the process of perception and analysis used to obtain it cannot be definite enough to be of much scientific value, and he argues against this. And all of our sensory systems and structures, etc., that's his argument in the randomness section, they only pick up structure in limited cases. So the structure is basically what we call complexity, right? So but if this is dependent on what tools we use to define randomness and to define structures, and how can you actually define complexity in a good way? And so, well, the way around this is basically not to define it at all. And that's, I think to me, this is one of the biggest points of the book, is that he never tries to make it rigorous. He just says that if I cannot do anything, I'm just not going to do it at all. That's it. I'm going to rid myself of the traditional mathematics with all of its rigor and, you know, with all of its rigor, with all the definitions and rigor, and I'm not going to make any definitions at all and see what, and this is what the new science is. So, actually this is a correct statement. I'm going to give a quote from this, which is almost exactly what I've just said. So what he says about complexity is the following. Just as one does not need a formal definition of life to study biology, so also it is not necessary to have a formal definition of complexity. Well, I guess a good point. You know, can any of the biologists in the room, if there are people present here, define what life is? I definitely cannot. Then he gives a bunch of more or less definitions, which are not quite rigorous. So what he says is that the greatest complexity lies in systems that neither stabilize nor exhibit close to uniform randomness forever, which is basically he tries to tell us that rule 110 is a complex system. He looks at it, he wants it to be complex, and that's what he tells us. Or another definition, we determine complexity by using our eyes and powers of visual perception. I just cannot buy this type of definitions. The problem is that how can you argue with these definitions? How can you analyze whether they're correct or not? How can you do anything with them? right? One point which she makes is the following, that when you talk about complexity again, it's complexity with respect to something. If you look at those pictures of cellular automata which I showed you, how complex are them? In his view, it's an ill-posed question, because basically if you're asking about the size, then all of them are about the same complexity. If you're asking about the intricate structure inside the pictures, then rule 110 is probably more complex, right? But again, I'm doing again an infomercial here, saying that what you should talk about is a predictive complexity. Basically, you want to extract all features that can be used to make some kind of predictions. And then there is no ambiguity with respect to what you're calculating complexity. Okay. This is not needed. Now, after these definitions of randomness and complexity, what are new points, new intuitions that we have about what the new kind of science is? So, as I get it, what he claims is that there is intrinsic randomness generation and there is no any other kind of randomness generation. We must never assume equilibrium. We should always we should not solve equations which are basically constraints, because they cannot produce complex behavior, but instead we should simulate evolution rules without assuming anything about them. And then he actually makes a very good point at one case, which is, look, if you are going to describe the world in terms of the short, simple programs, it's not good to reject them outright, because basically, yes, we believe that, for example, the Earth's motion around the Sun is described by differential equations. But do you believe that there is a computer inside the Earth which actually solves those differential equations and guides the Earth where to move? It's a model, right? So what he says is that his models, which are short programs, are as good as models of traditional mathematics, which are traditional physics, differential equations. And the only way to judge whether the models are good or not is to see what the outcome of applying these models is, which I think is a reasonably good comment, a reasonably good point. Now, either of those things on the previous slide new? Well, I mean, do not assume equilibrium. I don't think it's actually a point at all. We have non-equilibrium stat mech. Constraints instead of implicit evolution rules. Well, in terms of mathematics, there is actually no difference between evolution rules and constraints. The difference actually appears in terms of Wolfram's models, it's very easy to apply evolution rules, but very difficult to apply constraints. So I actually view this as a problem not of traditional mathematics, but rather a problem of Wolfram's short programs as described in the world. In traditional science, we try to make predictions. We try to understand what's going to happen with the system. What Wolfram does what he suggests us to do is, well, take a program, execute it all the way to the end, and see what you get. This doesn't allow to make predictions. I have to execute the program all the way to the end, which, for all I know, may not even halt, right? So it's not a predictive approach to science. And he actually, again, in similar fashion as he defined complexity, he later takes this as a postulate that you cannot ever do anything better than just evaluation of program all the way to the end. I'll get to this. And why I think that science is, making predictions actually what science does, and it actually is possible to do, is basically, well, if we move outside, we're not being hit by trucks, right? So we can actually predict that if there is no truck in the vicinity, it's not going to hit us in the next moment. So we are trying to make predictions, and as animals living in the world, we are trying to make predictions. And this seems to be enough. We're not being hit by trucks, right? So maybe we should just focus on making predictions and forget about all of those things that Wolfram is talking about. And I guess what he would argue, he would say, is that all of these cases like being hit by a truck is a very simple case, which is very simple to analyze, but there are millions and millions of other situations which are just not easy to analyze, and let's do those. Maybe, but as I am saying, simple cases seem to be enough to survive. Now, the probably quite an interesting part. I'm coming to the second part of the, actually last part, no, second. Third quarter of the book, which talks about applications of this to real natural science systems. And so the first systems are biological systems. So I'm giving a quote again. I believe that many of the most obvious examples of complexity in biological systems have actually nothing or very little to do with adaptation or natural selection. In almost any kind of system, many choices of underlying rules inevitably lead to a behavior of great complexity. Basically, what he says is that we have to throw away all of our knowledge about natural selection, evolution, and just say that vast majority of features in biological systems do not correspond to anything being optimal. They're just random, right? They're just but natural selection, what happens is that the animals are filled with those small programs which generate all sort of randomness, intrinsic randomness. You sample all possible space of possible behaviors of animals, and then the role of natural selection is actually much simpler than what we thought before. What this role of natural selection is just to smooth things out, to separate your animal into the organs, right? So it's easy to simplify things, so to make sure that if you make a small change to a program, to the genetic program, there is no huge drastic changes in the behavior. This controls this is what natural selection does. But the sampling is performed by deterministic computers which produce intrinsic randomness inside of the cells. And basically what he says about us is that, well, of all animals, bacteria are the most optimal. They produce the most offsprings. And so the reasons for existence of all higher organisms, including us, is that basically these are random mutations, randomness generated by internal DNA, right? We just happened to add no fatal flaws. Again, this is not predictive science because you can explain things a posteriori, but not why these things happened. But actually, all of this being said, he actually gives a few very simple and very cute problems, very cute examples, which I liked, right? And basically what I think is happening is the following, is that maybe he is right in the sense that not everything is determined by evolution, that a lot of stuff is actually random. And again, I don't think that people would argue against this sentence. What people would argue against is that everything is random. So the example that he gives are the following. Suppose you just have a program for producing a shell, and you have a bunch of parameters. What happens if you just tweak these parameters at random? These are typical possible types of shells which you can produce. And these are shells which he has in his house, just, you know, bought somewhere in the flea market, etc., etc. All look the same. So yeah, I think it's a good point, basically, that in some cases maybe what happens is that it's just different programs. It doesn't really matter what kind of shell you have for an animal, and so different programs just produce different results, right? Again, this looks like very much like leaves of different animals, or different plants. These are not leaves, these are substitution systems with different substitution rules. So again, you just randomly sample rules and you get all possible leaves. And so what it means is that it doesn't make sense to ask why the leaf on this particular tree is of this form. It just happened to be this way, it's just an accident. That's his view. But the problem is that somehow, again, this is not predictive and I don't know what to do with this, right? The next is pigmentation on shells. And again, you can view it as a cellular automata, and this is the type of pigmentations which you have on these shells, right? And so this one, for example, or this one looks like rule 30. This one looks very much like, something else over here, for example, etc. So basically what he says is that pigmentation, which is essentially a one-dimensional process, indeed does look like a cellular automaton. So maybe there's just a bunch of simple programs which are very easy to accidentally change, and they do not introduce a fatal flaw in the system, and that's what happens. And then this is a pigmentation colors on zebras or on cheetahs, so it's et cetera, et cetera. Again, this is just two-dimensional cellular automaton, started with different initial conditions, with slightly different rules, and that's what you get. So again, the question is, maybe you shouldn't even be asking questions why a zebra has these stripes. It just happens this way. You can basically simply produce this by random mutations. And I think actually, as I already mentioned, this is not an absurd point. Next.
It is disproven in many of these cases where there is evidence for evolution for these patterns on some shapes that...
Let's do it. Let me finish because I'm running already. I still have about 20 minutes and I only have 10 minutes for the talk, and then after that. Okay, so statistical mechanics. Well, he says that his programs are capable of capturing the essence of statistical mechanics even though we cannot. Well, I would argue with this because I think we understand quite well what statistical mechanics is. So, if you want to have, I mean, he acknowledges that that nature seems to be reversible, right? So you have to have reversible cellular automatons. Very simple cellular automatons cannot produce reversibility. So he adds on some rules. The rules are slightly more complicated, but not that complicated, and you get reversible cellular automaton. And then what he notices is that some of these reversible cellular automatons show some kind of intrinsic randomness, which he takes as the central phenomenon responsible for second law of thermodynamics. Basically, you start from something which is not random, but then intrinsic randomness generates entropy increase in the system. Could be not. I don't think it actually makes any difference. That's the point. And what he says, which is now, you know, maybe a slightly more significant point, is that in practice, I mean, if this is true, if randomness is actually produced by cellular automaton, then in some cases you actually should see how randomness goes down. But we never, there are some automata which actually take complex random signals and actually produce, you know, the black patterns as I showed in the beginning of the talk. But actually we never see that, so why? And basically what he says is that when we do experiments, it's only with very carefully prepared initial conditions. You know, we have 1 kilogram of this, 2 kilograms of that, mixed together, see what happens. And so if the initial conditions are very random, very simple, they cannot become yet simpler. They're already as simple as they can possibly be. So no wonder why we don't get any entropy decrease. So, I mean, reasonably good point. Again, I don't know what to make out of it. It's definitely not a new kind of science, but I think which you should probably ask yourself at some point when you're studying statistical mechanics or teaching it. So what he finally ends the section with is that second law is an important, quite general principle, but it's not universally valid. Again, I think he's not inventing.
You want not.
It is not universally valid. I skipped not here, right? Yeah, it's not universally valid. And again, I think that not too many people would argue against this statement. Now, the next part, which is the basic physics, space-time, how it's built, etc., etc. Well, I knew that by this time I would be running late, so it's only going to be one slide or two slides, something like that. But again, we can do it later after the talk. So what he says is that underneath all of the complex phenomena we see in physics, there lies some simple program which, if run for long enough, would reproduce our universe in every detail. That's his. That's the theory which he is trying to work with, and you know, trying to work with this theory, he provides some. Some ideas of, you know, how this may happen. So first of all, he says that the only assumption, the only reason why we actually think that space-time is continuous at very, very low short scale is because it's easier for us to apply calculus to it. So if we don't need calculus anymore, if we're working with programs, let's just forget it and let's not assume that the space is continuous. So from now on, space and time are discrete. And then the universe is basically, again, quoting for him, universe might work as a mobile automaton or a Turing machine. Basically what you do is you name every single point in space-time and then connect these points in a partially ordered set, which is in a way that the connections only go in the causal direction. So it's going to be a causal network where every point is connected to its offsprings in the every point in space-time is connected to its to those to its offsprings, right? Well, he actually gives very interesting things. Like suppose that the universe is actually not a mobile automaton but actually a multi-way machine. In this case, the universe will actually sample different histories. Not only will it be discrete and have this beautiful structure, but it will actually have many different universes sampling all possible types of histories. The questions which I have are, how can you test all of this stuff? And at the moment, he is only building his theory, so he cannot provide testable predictions. However, let's go to a few obvious problems which you might have with this theory. So we know the space-time is relative, right? I mean, there's theory of relativity. So how do you work with this? How do you impose theory of relativity on this network? And he has what I would say a reasonably clever solution. If you say that all of the connections here on this plot are all of lengths Planck time and Planck lengths, or rather they actually have to be the same lengths. Doesn't necessarily have to be Planck, I think, but exactly the same lengths. Then what will happen is that different slices through this network, slices which only cut network in such a way that you never go in the opposite direction of this causal edge, are just different coordinate systems. You are looking, this is still a causal structure, just looking at it at different angles. So this should correspond somehow to changing coordinate transformations in relativistic physics. And it's actually quite easy to prove that this way you are able to get geometrical properties of special relativity. You can get a time dilation, you can get length contraction, and it's not difficult at all. It's basically the same argument as you had before, it's just not difficult. The things which you cannot get are things which are not spatial, like the famous E equal to mc squared, it just doesn't emerge from here. And so how do you get it? He doesn't have an answer, because if he would probably write it down. I couldn't find an answer. So some aspects you can get, some aspects, I mean, most of them you cannot. What are elementary particles and gravity in this picture? Elementary particles are just defects in this space-time causal network. And interactions may be made such to preserve total number of spatial nodes in this network, which would correspond to different conservation laws in physics. And what it would correspond to, basically, if you look at the 110 rule, 110 solar automaton, this is a very regular structure, which, you know, you can view it as a network in some sense, and these propagating structures on top of this network, the different propagating structures, are defects in this network. And that's what he, you know, by analogy, he thinks that real particles are defects in the underlying space-time network. And gravity is just changing the pattern of connections in this networks. Basically, you count the number of nodes which are your neighbors, and then the number of nodes which are neighbors of your neighbors, etc., etc., etc. And this should scale as the dimensionality of the space, but then there's going to be a subleading correction, which is basically proportional to Ricci scalar. So in some way, you can see how the curvature effects may, you know, come to give you general relativity. Again, this is talking. There is no any results that he gives us. So what is the news that we get from about this new kind of science from this physics part of his book? The news are that basically space, time, interactions, particles, everything in this world is just coming from the same space causal space-time network. It's just different properties of that network. The problem is that if you want to do general relativity, he acknowledges even that, you know, so far you need to put mass explicitly in. He cannot work it out. So, and I doubt he will be able to, but we'll see. Randomness in quantum mechanics is all intrinsically generated. EPR time problems may be very easily overcome if you allow this this causal space-time network have threads connecting particles which you cannot actually observe. Again, he doesn't give details about this. And well, to conclude this is, I have to say that he is able to produce some of the properties of physics, namely some aspects of special relativity in this case. What to make out of it, it's basically, it's your decision, okay? Now, the next part, which, as I said, I will run 10 minutes over and I will finish it in 10 minutes. The next part of the book is computations. So basically, his view is that everything in the world is computation. And it's not a bad view, it's just trivial in some sense. Basically, everything is, for example, if you look at water, water is a computer which is solving Navier-Stokes equation. Fine, I don't have any problems with such interpretation. Now what he says is that some computations are reducible, that is, you can predict what the result is going to be without doing them, but some other computations are not reducible. Traditional science can deal only with those computations which are reducible, hence we get limits on traditional science. Again, the same question, do we care about those computations which are irreducible? Then what he goes on is, again, he does zoology of possible computers, and he finds out that there is a bunch of them which are actually universal computers. That is, they can simulate any other computer given proper initial conditions. And what's interesting is that even the very simplest computers, there is a bunch of them which are universal. And I think that this is actually quite an interesting result. I did not myself expect, for example, that rule 110 is a universal computer, but it is. It's not his proof, but that's a different story. What he notices is that threshold for universality among these computers is actually very, very low, that quite a lot of computers are universal. You only need a few rules to make them universal. So, for example, he claims, which may be the case, that all class 4 cell automatons are universal computers, and basically how you achieve this is, in class 4 automatons you have this propagating structures, and by carefully arranging the structures you may sort of manipulate bits. Two things collide, they collide, move apart, etc., etc. This is some kind of manipulation on bits in the system. And this is actually how you prove universality of 110 cell automaton. Yeah, or game of life, right? So what he says is that I suspect that in almost any case where we have seen complex behavior, it will be possible to show that there is universality. This is probably slightly far-fetched, and I don't believe this, but in many cases probably there is universality. It would be nice if you actually proven it, but that's a different story. Now, this has two cell automata which are universal. This is some huge cell automata which has 20 colors, blah, 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 blah. And so here it's done to simulate the behavior of cell automaton rule 18, which I showed you in the beginning of the talk. So what you see here is that by identifying blocks of, I think it's 40 by 40 or something like that, I don't remember the exact numbers, of this cell automaton with one point in rule 18 cell automaton and creating proper initial conditions, you can get universality. This one is a highly magnified view of, highly demagnified view of rule 110, where the only stuff which is left is structures. We've removed all the background and just left the propagating structures. And here, how this computer basically works. You have structures coming from the right, you have structures coming from the left, and if you are clever enough, you can arrange them to do whatever you really want them to do. And this is how you prove the universality of this rule 110. Finally, he ends his book with something which he calls principle of computational equivalence, which, to my understanding, this is the most important part of his book as viewed by Wolfram, my understanding. So here is the formulation of principle of computational equivalence. Almost all processes that are not obviously simple can be viewed as computations of equivalent sophistication. I don't know what to make out of this. What is obviously simple, what is equivalent sophistication, I just really do not know what this means. And again, this is the same problem. You cannot argue with this because there is no definition being done. So what this actually does, according to Wolfram and according to the colloquial interpretation of that sentence, is establish an upper limit on computational sophistication. We are as complex as the piece of metal, because all of the electrons there are unpredictable. They are performing every possible computation as you can, but we're also as complex as the whole universe. There is an upper limit which almost everybody is reaching. So what he says is that most systems are universal. There is principle of computational equivalence. There are some systems which are universal. Therefore, most systems are universal. Therefore, most systems are irreducible, and that's what I promised to David a few minutes ago. This is a statement which I was trying to tell earlier. Almost any statement that can readily be investigated by the traditional methods of mathematical proofs will tend to be largely irrelevant to the true principle of computational equivalence. Really, I do not know what to say after this. Basically, what he says is that whatever we say is just going to be irrelevant to him. That's it. That's right. Yeah. It's probably a good closing point, but basically this statement, he goes on and on to sample all possible axiom sets, etc., 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 and he shows that this principle of computational equivalence is related to undecidability, basically all of your mathematical axiom from a mathematics is basically applying rules to initial conditions, rules which are given by axioms. So you can, as well as you were sampling all possible cell automata, sample all possible axiom sets. And so what you will find is that vast majority of axiom sets are actually universal, and therefore they're incomplete, which sort of agrees with Gödel's indecidability. And so what he says is that in the future, when the ideas of methods of this book have successfully been absorbed, the field of mathematics as it exists today will come to be seen as a small and surprisingly uncharacteristic sample of what is actually possible. Which is, as far as I understand, it's very much related to Wigner's statement about unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in natural sciences, right? That's what I think he tries to do. Right? He says that mathematics is effective only because we have focused ourselves on very specific, very small subset of all possible problems. And that's what Wigner was asking in that question, in that article. Well, he puts a bunch of applications of this to intelligence, to human thinking. The first one is basically, he says that since all of the definitions of complexity, etc., etc., is all with the rules which we have, how can we possibly be able to distinguish extraterrestrial, say, intelligence from pure random noise? It may have some underlying structure, but without knowing what has generated that structure, we will think of it is as random. And I think this is a point which is always asked at SETI presentations, SETI talks. So he's not actually the one to make it the first. Now, I want to actually focus on this one, free will. So what he says is that basically since all of the systems are irreducible, they're all deterministic, but you cannot know what the system will do without actually simulating it all the way with all of its details, etc., etc., which may be responsible for free will. It is deterministic, but it looks like it is random. That's his point. And the last slide is, so what are the last additions which I get from the sort of last two or three parts of the chapters of the book to what the new kind of science is? So most systems are irreducible, which probably is the case. And if there is any randomness, then the randomness is only intrinsic, which I don't know whether this is true or not. Most systems are as complex as they can get, fine. They cannot be predicted at all. Some aspects of them are probably possible to predict, again, like in the air, we know what the temperature is, etc., etc. Traditional science is useless for making analysis of those irreducible systems. But then the last point is actually from me, not from Wolfram, is that aside from stating uselessness of traditional science, in my view, his new kind of science does not do better, basically. It just doesn't make any kind of predictions. At least our science does some. That's it.
I think we should thank Ilya for undertaking a very difficult task. But I can also sense that many people, especially in the front, including David Gross, are getting more and more agitated. Jump up. But I need to remind people that Ilya Neumann is not Stephen Wolfram. So as I said in the beginning, everyone who wishes to comment and express their opinion is welcome to do so. But I have a list of people that I actually asked to express their opinions. The first one is Jim Harder. But Jim has come prepared with transparency, so why we set the transparency?
Actually, we start probably with David, because I think he's one of the people
on the list.
But he's, I think, the only people of from everybody in the room who is actually in the thank you list in the book. No? Okay. Sorry, my mistake.
Okay, so the second person on my list is Jim Langer.
I'd rather wait until Jim Hartle has a chance.
No.
Jim has got it.
Really? You are second on the list. Why do you?
Well, it wants to know why he's in first.
Jim always has very much more thoughtful thoughts about things.
No, but in the interest of saving time, should we, since we are running a little bit late. Okay, good. Well, when Tony asked me to give this talk, right, I tried to beg off on the grounds that I hadn't read Stephen Wolfram's book, and I still haven't read Stephen Wolfram's book. But Tony sent me back an email that said, well, if you haven't read it, you'll just be all that more objective. So I didn't have a ready answer for that, and that's why I'm speaking. I really have to congratulate the speaker for giving what was a very stimulating compression of 1,200 pages, right? And after hearing him, I think I'm going to go out and buy a copy of the book, as long as I can find a bookstore where I won't be seen by any member of the UCSB physics department. So I'm not sure the remarks I had to make today will have anything to do with Wolfram, because I haven't read it, and it may be orthogonal. Now let me begin just by saying that the basic laws of, I'm speaking into this, is it?
Okay.
You want me to put this on or just hold it? The basic laws of physics allow us to compress our description of the universe by exhibiting its regularities. And the simplest example of that is, of course, dynamical laws that govern regularities over time. In the language of algorithmic information theory, right, we have a description of the evolution over a long time, and that can be compressed into some sort of dynamical law, which is a short program, plus initial conditions. And so we get a compression of our description of the universe, right, from a long string describing entire evolution to a short one. Now, it's possible that everything in the universe is described, every detail of every leaf, every event in human history, every human thought, and the number of bodies in every planetary system is described by a very short computer program with a very long output. That, I take it, is at least partially related to the substance of what was discussed today. And these might be modeled, for example, by cellular automata. If that's the case, then the universe is vastly more regular than it seems than we thought today. But the point I want to emphasize is, for such a fundamental law to be discoverable and to be implementable, it must not only be simple, it must also be, its predictions must be computable, right, in a short period of time, and not a time, for example, if it has to explain the whole universe, which is comparable to the age of the universe. So that's certainly possible if the basic laws of physics explain only some things, that is, our universe is only somewhat regular and not completely regular, but doesn't explain everything. If the basic laws have to explain every single detail in the universe, then one has to worry about, is there enough time in the 14 billion years since the Big Bang, or the 13.7 billion years according to MAP, for the computer program to run? And secondly, where would the output be stored? Right? For example, if you just take a description of the universe at a sort of millimeter scale, there aren't enough protons in the universe to make the CDs that would be necessary to write that description down. By contrast, right, contrasting point of view with this completely deterministic one is provided by quantum mechanics. And I just want to put in a little pep talk for quantum mechanics. The idea the great thing about a quantum mechanical description of the universe, which after all is, as far as we can tell from the evidence of the last 75 years, the most basic one that we have, is that one can have complete information about a system of the universe and yet predict very little. From its initial condition and its initial quantum state in its Hamiltonian, you can seek to predict probabilities in the universe. Such a system predicts probabilities for every single alternative, For example, it predicts probabilities for whether the stock market will go up tomorrow or not go up tomorrow. But those probabilities typically don't contain much information. They're 50-50. Otherwise, to quote my colleague Gell-Mann, you know, I could get rich knowing the wave function of the universe, and that's obviously impossible. Only a few things, for example, the large-scale structure of the universe, the galaxy-galaxy correlation function, are probably predicted with a probability near one. So I'd just like to put in a plug. It may be that the universe is deterministic as been suggested, but it's also possible that simple general features of the universe can be encoded in a single computable initial condition, and that all the complexity that we see about us arises from the action of gravitational attraction and quantum accidents that have taken place over the 14 billion years of its history. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, I call upon Professor Langer.
Jim Langer. Jim Langer, actually, look.
This you have to deal with yourself. With that, the pointer is turned on.
Okay, I don't have anything to project, so it's not.
You want my transparency?
I don't think I have very much to say. I took a very different point of view than Jim about what I might, you know, remark about the book. My question was, well, is there something that is conceivably useful for me here? You know, it does the do Stephen Wolfram's ideas, do they provide me? Well, already Ilya has told us that they don't make predictions, but the question, a somewhat better way of phrasing that, I think, is, you know, do they provide me some new discovery tool? And so I thought to myself, well, you know, let's think about it that way. Is this some tool that I could use? Now, of course, I'm half engineer these days, and so I looked at the practical questions that he was addressing, and I think on page 360 something or other, he has a section in which he talks about crystal growth. That's it. And 369 it starts up. And I suspect that this is why, by the way, I didn't buy this book. Stephen sent it to me, and I suspect he sent it to me because I think 20 years ago he and I had had a talk about pattern formation and crystal growth. Indeed, you know, he has a set of cellular automata rules that produce things that look a bit like real snowflakes. And then I read through to see, well, what he was saying, how he had generated this. And in fact, his rules are based on, at least in a rudimentary way, on some understanding of what produces the shape instabilities that lead to snowflake crystal growth. Now, you add to a corner, and that's, you know, it's essentially the diffusional instability, that diffusion fluxes are higher at sharp points, which is, of course, in a very rudimentary way, how these intricate structures actually form. And by the way, they're at least momentarily violating the second law of thermodynamics. There's order that is being produced in ways that I think we understand quite well. So, indeed, this is his cellular automata here are caricatures of models that we have actually used to create intricate pictures, you know, of that kind. They capture some particular element of it. However, the models, the insight that he's using there, far from, you know, being a discovery tool for me, simply said that, well, I needed to understand the physics first, the continuum laws of how diffusion occurs, how fluid flows, how solids emerge, and then I can make, based on that, some rather interesting cellular automata. That is not to say that that's not a reasonable thing to do. is that it, in fact, in many cases, we have found in thinking about pattern formation that it is indeed useful to oversimplify the computer programs in order to generate, you know, patterns or to test certain ideas. In those cases, however, what you have to do is to make a theory of the computer program, which is not exactly, in fact, it's exactly the opposite, I think, of what Stephen wants to do here. The next page could also have come from a discussion with me, because he talks about the fracture. And there, the trouble is that we still, after 50 years or so of thinking about this, and maybe 10 or 15 years after having really finally got good experiments on the subject, we don't know what the analog of that instability is. And therefore, you know, so far as I can tell, this picture has not allowed me to gain any insight about what fracture actually consists of. I was really impressed and pleased. I thought you did a wonderful job in trying to figure out, you know, what it is he's saying, what kinds of things he might be getting at that would be of philosophical interest to us. But from my, as I say, practical point of view, I didn't find a discovery tool in the book. But maybe I will. That's all.
The person I'd like to call on is Johannes Voucher. I'm particularly curious to see what a young string theorist has to say.
I don't think that much people. Probably spent more of the time than I should have preparing this, actually reading the book. So I actually read the book. And I should say only the main part of the book, not the notes, which consist maybe half the length, but maybe much more of the content of the book. But and I actually enjoyed reading the book. So as Ilya showed you, there are some really nice pictures in there, and I think I learned quite a bit about the cellular automata and so on. But this is one thing I enjoyed actually reading the book, and I think it was interesting. I should also say that, I mean, you should not, I think we should not just dismiss this book just because it's sort of its style or something like this. I mean, I've seen, because it's unconventionally presented, or I've seen quite some commentators, just dismissing the book based on the fact that it was published in an unconventional way by Wolfram himself and so on and so forth. Then there are two things in which I would sort of disagree with Wolfram. So the first, I mean, Ilya mentioned this already, so to what extent is this new? Wolfram's most important discovery, he says, is that simple systems can show complex behavior. And I think to some extent this is what we always do in science, right? We try to reduce the complex behavior we see in nature to some simple description, so that I think is just not very new. And so the last thing is about this predictability and complexity. So I think there's maybe too much emphasis to my taste on the question of predictions. I mean, so of course predictions are very crucial if we want to in our understanding, but I think they're not the only goal. I think the goal really should be to describe nature as a whole, not to make predictions about these individual experiments. So if Wolfram's question he asks is about to what extent can you predict the outcome, I think this is just not the main goal of what science should be. Okay, thank you.
David, tell us like this. No mincing of words. Is it garbage or not?
Shed your usual reticence.
Right.
Well, I'm not going to pronounce in that deterministic a fashion. But anyway, first I'd like to thank Ilya for doing an incredible job. And one that might be very useful to me, I was actually asked by the people in Aspen who run their lecture series there in the summer to debate Stephen Wolfram. And this was supposed to be arranged. Desire to have a deterministic universe. I think that one of the people, philosophers, scientists, what would you call him, behind and this whole set of ideas and had a big influence on Wolfram, that somehow nature is in the end discrete. Now, this is very important to somebody who's writing computer programs, but it's not been part of fundamental science. But a lot of people would like to imagine that the world is discrete. That space and time are latticized, and that behind it all, there's just a countable set of things whose connections and relations form the observable universe. That's one clearly put but not stated desire behind this whole approach. And of course, we have a lot of evidence to the contrary, because continuum methods and infinity has served us well for hundreds of years. But it might be the case. But this whole approach is strongly based on both a desire to have a discrete universe, an accountable universe, And in a sense, a dislike of infinity. Very important concept. The other thing that underlies all of this, and in which he runs into serious problems in chapter 9, is a desire to have a deterministic universe. And he seems to really believe, in the end, that the world is deterministic, like Mathematica is. And if something goes wrong, there's a bug, and you write to him, and he fixes it, and then it won't go wrong again. It's all deterministic, and the apparent indeterminism of quantum mechanics is merely an illusion. And again, this is a desire, as we all know, of many people, but it again flies in the face of what has been one of the most successful approaches to nature that we've come to grips with over the last century. It seems to work. And it's not that I'm, especially as a string theorist, not willing to give up and indeed expect that we're going to have to change our notions of space and time, maybe even of quantum mechanics, but I'm a little disappointed by sort of these simplistic hopes for a discrete, countable, and deterministic universe that simply lies behind it in this rather boring way. Furthermore, there's an important issue here, which is that having these simple programs, the cellular automata that reproduce in phenomena that look like traditional physics, is not that surprising, because after all, when we try to solve our fundamental equations, which give us, as Johannes explained, not just often an exquisitely predictive tool, but a general understanding of how nature works. When we try to actually often do the predictions numerically, we discretize the system, put it on a lattice, and if we have locality in space and in time, then the discrete time evolution of those discretized PDEs is essentially a cellular automata, with perhaps a few more states than the simplest examples that Stephen looked at, but that's what it is. So it's not surprising at all that it might be surprising that such trivial examples of discretized PDEs give rise to once in a while to interesting behavior, but it's not at all surprising they do, because they're just discretized PDEs. However, if you were to give up locality in space, so that the rules for a given cell depended on all neighbors, not just the few nearest neighbors, the rules would be as complex as the whole behavior. You'd have to know, in order to predict delta t equals 1, the whole system of the whole universe. So he essentially uses, to get simplicity, locality. Now that's fine, because we too believe that locality, the fact that only nearby events affect each other, is crucial to our understanding of nature. But then in chapter 9 he comes to quantum mechanics. And he has a deterministic cellular automaton. We're supposed to reproduce the funny correlations between things on opposite sides of the universe. So he says, well, that's no problem. We'll have these strings, these causal connections in his space-time network whose defects are particles all across the universe. Seems to me at that point, as in other attempts to have a deterministic universe, he's giving up locality. But in his framework, once he gives up locality, then the initial state and the first step in his evolution is as bad as the whole damn thing, and it's just a total mess. So, that's what I have to say.
Some of you may be getting impatient and wondering how many more speakers I have. Two more speakers. The next is Mark Stranitsky.
I have nothing useful to say.
Okay, finally, the last speaker is Walter Cohn.
Not really a speaker. Number one, I have not even held a book in my hands. Number two, I did not prepare anything, but I promised Tony that I would come, and that if I felt that I have a few thoughts that might be pertinent, I'll try them out here. So that's what I'd like to do. What I'd like to do is sort of in some sense, similar in spirit to Jim Langer's, is to relate it to some things that I've thought about, and some points you will find similar to points that Jim Hartle made. I've been started developing what's called density functional theory about 40 years ago, and I've been working off and on it ever since. It turns out that density functional theory, and let me limit myself here to density functional theory of electronic structure, turns out to be useful in some cases very useful, for systems with many degrees of freedom. So there is something that sort of begins to connect with the word complexity. I'm also going to ask myself, and I did ask myself, and the question, Can I get something practical and useful out of such a concept? And I think possibly the answer is yes. So I'll try and compress my presentation here. Density functional theory is, in its simplest form, a really extreme simplification of a many-body problem. Many-body problem deals in, I'm talking about quantum mechanics now, and I'm talking about non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So it deals with the problem of solving a Schrödinger equation in a large number of dimensions. Let me just say that on a logarithmic scale, my conclusion is that the number of dimensions where you get a kind of crossover from simple to quote-unquote complex is not a huge number. It's a number on whose logarithm is something like 2 or 3. Now, what's the nature of this crossover? And here there's a little connection with the remark that Jim made, Jim Hartle. It's very easy to convince yourself that you can conceptualize and even write down symbolically a wave function depending on, let us say, a wave function for an atom with 100 electrons, right? You just have to be relatively patient and write down these 100 coordinates. That's not hard. But on the other hand, I convinced myself, and I have a feeling Jim probably would agree with that, that once you get to something like a wave function in 100, for 100 particles, let's say in 300 dimensions, it is in principle not representable, cannot be written down. There's not enough protons, as you said, and there isn't enough time to compute it. Now, can we do it rather accurately? In a certain sense, the answer is a resounding no. And in another sense, it's actually perhaps a fairly timid yes. The no is that there is no wave function that in the real universe, in the real finite universe that has a finite number of particles that has existed for a finite length of time. You make back of the envelope calculations, you find that once you get to something like this number of 100 or 1,000 particles, the best wave function you can conceivably calculate in our real universe would have an overlap with the quote-unquote true wave function, which exists only in some sort of platonic universe, that is just exponentially small, e to the minus 100 or something like that. So in that sense, it's totally meaningless. In another sense, it of course gives useful results, because even such a totally bad wave function allows you to compute quite useful physical quantities like the total energy, and that can be fairly precise. Fairly in quotation marks precise. Nothing like this exponentially meaningless thing. So as not to be up here too long, I just want to say that, and it's a little related to the remark about non-locality that you heard. I think that these limitations that we exist in a universe of finite size and of finite duration, will imply, will imply that there are physically significant limitations on the accuracy with which not Wolframian, but quote-unquote normal science can compute things. I come from condensed matter physics, so I know a fair amount about metals and insulators and stuff like that. And this non-locality is particularly strong in metals. It's much weaker in insulators. So I believe that in metals, there is a kind of an ultimate limitation. As uncrossable as, let's say, the Heisenberg limitations are, there's an ultimate limitation to the accuracy with which you can compute things due to this finiteness of the universe that sets some limits on what you can do. But the amazing thing is that everything is comes down by logarithms. So this finiteness of the universe, I would say again, with logarithmic accuracy, I suspect means that metallic properties cannot be calculated with an accuracy of greater than 0.1% or something of that sort. So I'll leave you with that. Thank you. Thank you.